Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu. Support for the Think podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
When Rana Oddish was admitted as a patient to the hospital where she worked, she learned more than she could have imagined about the way medicine fails patients. She mostly trusted the clinical judgments of the doctors taking care of her, but she felt dehumanized by the ways they related to her, reducing her life-threatening illness to a fascinating case rather than treating her like a real person. And she realized she had done the same thing to her own patients. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Oddish's physical recovery was slow and it was difficult, but she eventually returned to work with a new focus on helping doctors really connect with their patients, which turns out not only to make a real difference in patients' health, but also to have a protective effect against rampant burnout within the health profession. Dr. Rana Oddish is a critical care physician and medical director of care experience for the Henry Ford Health System. Her new book is called In Shock: My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. She joins us from the studios of WDET in Detroit to talk about it. Rana, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
The day you became gravely ill, initially you just felt a little off. You were 7 months pregnant at the time. Did you assume the pregnancy had something to do with just not feeling great that day?
Yes, you know, I think pregnancy is one of those states that you don't experience until you're in it, and everyone tells you it's normal to feel off and it's normal to feel unwell, and it's hard to have a gauge for what's true and what's not when you haven't been through something before.
So you went to the emergency room at the hospital where you worked as a physician. That had to be a surreal experience, suddenly being on the other side of things.
Very much so. And in fact, although I had been targeting the emergency room where I worked because I did believe that I had an intra-abdominal catastrophe, a true emergency, because I was pregnant, I was redirected to labor and delivery and bypassed that level one trauma center, which I think changed the experience in many ways because the focus really did turn to the health of the baby.
And you say redirected, it was like a custodian who said, everybody who's this far along with a pregnancy has to go to labor and delivery.
It was our hospital security guard. Okay. Yes, they manned the doors of the ER, and that's our hospital policy. Our hospital is very focused on safety, and much of that is done through having policies in place. And so for us, if someone's more than 24 weeks pregnant, they go to L&D.
Things very quickly went from bad to worse for you. You were diagnosed with something called HELLP syndrome. Can you give us just a quick explanation of what that is so that we can follow along with the rest of the story?
Yeah, when my labs initially came back, what was very clear was that I had almost no blood cells left. My hemoglobin was 3, and the blood cells that are responsible for clotting, called platelets, were also terribly low, and my liver was failing. That constellation of symptoms is referred to as HELLP syndrome.
So you're losing these huge amounts of blood internally. How aware were you of what was going on?
In that moment when I presented to labor and delivery and I was truly in shock from the blood loss, I still maintained that perspective of a critical care physician. And it was almost as if I was observing the events with intellectual curiosity. I was thinking, wow, this is what shock feels like. This is my brain being deprived of blood. I have this woozy, drunken feeling. I can't focus. My words feel out of reach. It was still clinically interesting to me, even as I knew that I was in horrible danger.
So you could hear and understand what was being said around you. At one point, one of your doctors said, she's trying to die on us. Why did that make you so angry?
That was when I woke in the ICU after that first very catastrophic night. And I overheard the rounding team in the hallway. And I very much, as a doctor, wanted to know what they were saying. That was how I was used to patients being presented. And I heard my clinical case and I was following along and then heard the resident report that I had been trying to die on him, as you said. And it made me so angry because of the directionality of the relationship that he was proposing. He was really saying that we were on opposite sides, that I was somehow fighting him. He was trying to keep me alive and I was an adversary in that. I was trying to die. And I thought that really attributing that intention to me was so false. And yet I recognized myself in that statement. I knew that I had viewed patients that way and I had viewed myself when I was a physician as their potential savior.
It's really interesting, too, because a sentence like that, she's trying to die on us, it makes it all about the doctor, right? It's like, oh, this is really difficult for me because I have to deal with this patient whose body is failing her.
Absolutely. It was located in him. He felt that he was being insulted by my care, right? And we do that as physicians. We do take many things personally, but to hear it expressed in that way, I think, was really hard.
When you arrived at the hospital, Rana, your baby's vital signs were strong. She didn't survive, ultimately. And this is just an extraordinary thing that you write about. You were able to spot her stopped heart on the ultrasound before the intern that was performing it, and he asked you to show him as if you were a resident in a white coat, instructing him about patient care.
Yeah, when the resident had first approached me with the probe, he very sweetly said, you know, bear with me, I'm not great at this yet. I could see his lack of familiarity with the ultrasound modality. And I thought to myself, you know, that's okay, I can still read these. I all know what he's seeing. I'd been ultrasounding myself in call rooms for the past few months. And as soon as he put the probe down, I could see that the heart was pulseless. And I said that out loud. I said, there's no heartbeat. And he replied, can you show me where you see that? And it truly was an expression of interest. He was looking at a test result that he didn't know how to interpret. And he saw that I did. And what was really noticeable in that interaction for me was that his perspective was really aligned entirely on himself. He had a mother who was dying in front of him, a baby that had already died, and he was really approaching it with clinical interest and intellectual curiosity and as a teaching moment, which is really how we train medical residents, that every experience with every patient is potentially a teaching moment.
I wonder if, because you showed him, I wonder if only later did you realize he completely ruined that and I deserved something very different.
Oh, I had a lot of anger about that interaction, and he didn't quite go away through my admission. He would come back later to tell me what a difficult night that was for him, the night that I nearly died. And I remember thinking, you know, perhaps I'm not the person you should be telling that to. But at the same time, he appeared so broken and so lost and questioning his own career choice. And, you know, as a physician, I had certainly had those moments where I had bad outcomes and it had rightly gutted me. And I had sympathy for him, but it was very hard to have to be the recipient of his pain when I was in so much pain myself. It wasn't really until far later that I had empathy for him, that I truly understood that he just didn't have the toolkit to deal with the things that had been placed in front of him. And many doctors, in fact, don't.
Everybody seemed to think they knew how you should respond to having lost your baby. One nurse chastised you for not wanting to hold her after she was stillborn. Reading that, I have to tell you, Rana, I just wanted to scream. How dare anybody tell you what you should want?
You know, medicine has a long tradition of presupposing what is right for our patients. It truly is ingrained in our history, and it's not one of the things that I'm proud of. But we are taught that we should direct people and that maybe we do have the answers. And that's changing, of course. But I believe that that nurse was acting in terms of what she believed were my best interests. She truly believed that it would help my healing to hold the baby, that I couldn't conceive of the fact that my baby had died were I not to hold her, and it would make it concrete for me. What she didn't leave room for was the fact that, you know, as a physician, I had a working concept of death, that I was truly happy to have survived. I wasn't perhaps mourning the loss in the way that I was expected to in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay, that we all have different approaches to grief. We have to ask generous questions and allow our patients to tell us what's right for them. We can't presuppose the answers.
Yeah, and to be clear, you were still very much in danger of dying at this point. It wasn't as if, and I don't know what to expect of anybody in this situation, but it wasn't as if you were going to walk out of that hospital 48 hours later. You were in serious danger.
I was. I was still critically ill. I had only just come off, you know, mechanical life support. I still had non-functioning kidneys, so I was holding on to 40 pounds of resuscitation fluid. I had not been out of bed in weeks. It was not where my head was at in that moment. I was trying to heal. And, you know, the timeline for my grief was very different, I think, than what was expected of me.
At one point, you had serious trouble breathing. There was nobody there watching over you, which is not so unusual, but you literally called a code on yourself to bring a crash team. Do you think you would have died if you didn't know how to do that?
You know, I don't. I know that I was in an ICU that truly is exceptional. And at some point, the alarms would have appeared real to the people who were monitoring me. It was just that my alarms were always sounding and we all had alarm fatigue at that point. And, you know, it's easy to let that become background noise as clinicians and nurses when you're exposed to it all the time. I do have the distinction of having called my own code, which I can tell you makes you pretty infamous in your own hospital. But ultimately, it gathered a team around me who were able to save my life again. What was truly shocking to me in that moment, though, you know, after they drained the fluid that was drowning me and after they got me breathing again, was how desperately I wanted to talk about what had just happened. How much I wanted to talk about how I had nearly died and how ill-equipped the team was to handle that. When I asked them if we could talk about what had just happened, you know, they gave me this very cognitive response of, well, you had fluid around your lung and we've drained it. And they assumed that my question was a request for data, when really it was an emotional question. It was, I'm scared. I nearly died. Can we talk about that? And that was one of those revelatory moments for me where I really realized that we're not trained as clinicians to decode the emotions that are behind our patients' questions. We truly do take every question as a request for data, and we supply it because that's something we've worked years towards. Knowing the right question, knowing the answer to the question when asked, is a very gratifying position for us to be in, and we're much less able to handle emotional cues.
My guest is Dr. Rana Audish. She's a critical care physician and medical director of care experience for the Henry Ford Health System. Her new memoir is called In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dr. Rana Oddish. She's a critical care physician and medical director of care experience for the Henry Ford Health System. Her book is called In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Rana, I assume that, you know, as a physician, especially one who is working in critical care, you can't lose it every time you lose a patient. You have to stay calm when things are really seemingly out of control with a patient. How were you taught during your training to manage your emotions and also to try to manage your patient's emotions?
You know, at the time that I was in medical school, which I started 20 years ago, one of the first lessons we were taught was in equanimitas. It's Latin for really imperturbability of emotion. And it was this idea that to be a physician, you could not react to situations in a way that was alarming to those around you. You had to maintain a sense of calm. What I think was missing in that was any sort of acknowledgement of what to do with those emotions. Where did you put them? How did you examine them? How did you move forward to the next case when surely the patient who just expired during a code affected you emotionally? So there was a lot of just disembodiment, a disconnection, but without a curriculum around how to manage it. And what was really frightening when we got to the wards was that if we did have emotion, that we were actually instructed that that emotion was a direct threat to our other patients. So that, you know, as naive, young, impressionable medical students who only wanted to help, to be told that to feel something for a patient would actually put them at risk was terrifying to us. And so we did bury them, so to speak, because we didn't have any understanding of what else to do. And medicine in so many ways to us was a club that we wanted to join. It was everything we had aspired to be. We would have taken any instruction that we were given to belong.
It's funny that
Please
continue. I'm sorry.
No, unfortunately, I think that was what was missing, that there was no answer provided to us.
Well, a couple of minutes ago, you used the word expired yeah. during a code. You mean died. I mean, no one outside the medical profession would say, my grandmother expired 4 years ago. This is a word used to separate you from the emotion.
And so much of our training was just that. It was making human things clinical. And our orientation in medical training was never to the person. It was always to the disease. We were infatuated by them. I think everyone who goes to medical school is in love with the human body and not just how it works, but how it doesn't work. And that was how we looked at things. You know, in many ways, patients were places where these diseases would land, but we didn't know how to see their humanness in every moment. We weren't taught in that way.
Over and over, you write about this hunger to be seen by your care providers. And it's such an interesting way to describe this because they could have told you everything about your blood oxygen saturation and the state of your liver. Surely they touched you in examining you, but you didn't feel like they saw you, Rana. They saw a body that was in crisis.
Yes. And that was one of the most surprising things to me, was how desperately I wanted to be seen and have my emotions validated. When I was just a physician, I thought that the way to reduce suffering was to treat the disease, because if the patient got better, then, you know, by definition, their suffering would decrease and I would have done my job. I never saw that tending to the emotional suffering was equally of value, if not more important, to tending to the disease itself. And that until I was a patient. And that was all I wanted, was to be seen.
It took you a long time, not surprisingly, to regain your strength. You know that even your medical colleagues seemed to think that you would make reliable progress toward good health every single day. It didn't work that way for you. It seems like your medical friends, of all people, would have understood this.
I think we all project our expectations onto others, and it's another situation where you can't possibly know what it feels like to inhabit a body that's broken in that way without being in it. And we tend to presume what a course should look like, what someone's path should be based on what we've seen in the past. But all I knew was what my body was experiencing and that it truly felt unable to do what was expected of it.
You write very candidly about a few years later, your little boy fell, his arm was hurting. He didn't seem to be in agony, so you just figured he was okay. It turned out his arm was broken. And your sense was like, I of all people should have understood this, but you also realized you so wanted him to be okay, that you unintentionally sort of disregarded the signs.
And this, I think, is one of those reasons we're all cautioned against treating our own family members, is because it's impossible to have any perspective when you're that close to somebody. You do want them to be okay. And so I superimposed my wish onto him and really looked for validating signs. So whatever supported my belief that he was okay was the only thing that I paid attention to. I disregarded the other things. It's classic confirmation bias, right? You believe what you want to believe.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Brittany is calling us from Dallas. Hi, Brittany.
Hi there. I want to thank you so much for this important topic. You know, I've been a chaplain in the hospital settings over the years, as well as worked in hospice, and it's so important what you're bringing to the forefront about this. And I think it's a systematic problem with also just the fear of liability about getting too close or the doctor admitting that there is something wrong and that death is a failure. You know, that they'll do anything to prolong life, but again, I think there's just so many a combination of factors, and I want to thank you so much for what you're doing to bring this issue out and just admitting that as a doctor you are human and y'all get sick too, and something, maybe this will be a beginning of something that we can start working together about, to improving communication on all levels of care, especially in a hospital institution type setting. Thanks
for your call, Brittany.
Yes, and I love that you use the word failure, because our language when we talk about sickness and health is so important. And one of the really remarkable things about the medical language, if you look at it, is how much battle terminology there is, how you fight something. We go to war, we win or lose, we give up. And just looking at that language tells you everything about how we position ourselves towards fighting disease, right? It's not about aligning with a patient on their journey, but seeing the disease as something to win or lose against. And that's a setup, because all of our patients will die. It's an inevitable fact. We are human. We can stave off perhaps death for some time, but we have to acknowledge our mortality.
Yeah, I always wonder about that battle language, because it's like one more burden on someone who has received a diagnosis that is really disturbing. As it, you know, you can have treatments or medication that works or don't work, but the idea that if you just want it hard enough, want it badly enough, you, the patient, have any control over what your body does.
I agree. I think we do a tremendous disservice, especially in the cancer population, of labeling it as a fight. You know, we are not empowered in that way. And ultimately, that's a fight against our own bodies, right? So what does that misalignment mean if you're the patient?
How did your illness change your relationship to your own body?
I learned to trust the signals that my body was sending me. I learned that my body had an inherent wisdom that I hadn't appreciated before. I had spent so much of my years in training learning to disregard my physical cues as well as my emotional cues, believing that, you know, they would just get in the way of clear thinking, so much so that during my first failed pregnancy, when I had this horrific swelling, I would wear compression stockings and I would refuse to sit down on ICU rounds because I believed it to be a concession. I believed that it would show me as weak. And as a woman in medicine, I didn't think there was any room for having a body. I believed I just needed to rise above that.
You're right about the fact that, yeah, physicians are often sort of expected to set aside the fact that they are hungry or tired or having a bad day, because that's just not what doctors do. Doctors are expected to be superhuman physically.
It's true. When I was in training, we still did 36-hour calls. So that meant we were awake and working for 36 hours without really any scheduled sort of break or time to rest. And that idea that we had to train in that way because it would make us stronger, it would make us able to handle anything, even if our bodies were failing and we were fatigued, that was where we would grow, is so misguided. And I'm so glad that the conversation these days is switching towards physician and provider wellness and wholeness. Because you can only meet somebody else and help them heal if you are healed yourself.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Yeah, with all due respect, I don't want you taking care of my kids when you're on
right.
hour 35.
No, we are not as alert. We're not as bright. We're not as cogent in those moments. And it's nonsense that we felt that was necessary. The trade-off, people will tell you, is that if you do shorter shifts, there's lack of continuity, there's increased handoffs, there's danger of medical error because of those handoffs. And finding that medium where physicians and all caregivers are rested and able to perform, but still able to have a care team that provides continuity, I think is necessary.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Sam in Denton. Hi, Sam.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate this conversation. And the first thing that came to mind was my sister actually is in the process of interviewing for medical school. And, you know, she's 29 and her whole life she's been working towards this. She got her undergrads and her master's in social work, and I think that's definitely a positive. And I'm wondering what your guests would have to say as far as training doctors on the more emotional side. You know how to better prepare for that.
I think your sister is already so well prepared, having had that background in social work. That is a school of thought that really understands the value of relationships. We are trying now to reinsert that back into medicine, because one of the things I think we're realizing is that we can't disembody physicians from their own emotions and then expect them to tend to the emotions in front of them. They will disengage from it because that's what they've been trained to do. And so we are building curriculums now that teach communication and empathy and really do allow for that connectedness to occur. But your sister's far ahead of the game.
We have an email here from Todd who says, I'm an anesthesiologist and encounter patients like you from time to time. And I know that doctors tend to be the worst patients. Do you feel your need for control as a physician hindered rather than aided your care? And Todd says, I'm worried about how I will handle my family's health care or my own without overstepping my boundaries.
It's so interesting because I do think that physicians do have this reputation of being controlling. But I will tell you that I immediately felt disempowered the second I had a hospital gown on. And we recently published a paper on what we called hostage bargaining syndrome, which manifests in all patients when they are, you know, in a position of lacking power. It really removes your sense of agency. The way that we have healthcare structured, there were times when I regained my voice and felt that I could advocate for myself, but I really feared retribution. I really worried that if I didn't behave, so to speak, if I didn't play the role of compliant patient, that I would be declined pain control, that I would be labeled, that I would be viewed differently. And so it's so interesting what our perspective of how we may handle something versus the reality actually manifests.
You heard a nurse out in the hallway complaining to your doctor, your patient's being difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, we label patients. That is something that anyone who works in healthcare knows. It's not something we're proud of. It's something we're working against. Even positive labels like she's really a fighter or upbeat can have damaging consequences because it might mean that we don't engage in difficult conversations based on how we've labeled a patient. You're not likely to talk about somebody's impending death if you're viewing them through that lens. And ultimately, all labels are very reductive. They're reducing someone to, you know, a word that can't possibly encompass all of their feelings or who they are.
My guest is Dr. Rana Oddish, critical care physician and medical director of care experience for the Henry Ford Health System. Her new memoir is called In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dr. Rana Oddish, critical care physician and medical director of care experience for the Henry Ford Health System. She's written a book called In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter @KERAThink. Rana, my children's pediatrician, they're in their mid to late teens now, so they don't visit that office anymore. But for years, we went there whenever necessary, and I never saw a glimmer of recognition from one visit to the next. I knew the nurses remembered my kids. I never felt like the doctor did, and he was very kind. But I wonder if maybe we as patients don't empathize enough with doctors. Maybe his burden was so great, you know, taking care of dozens of little kids in an average week, that it was too much to ask for him to remember.
You know, as physicians, I know that we're not the most sympathetic character in the story. The patient takes precedence in every way, but you touch on something really important, which is that there is this mission conflict. I think there's so much that is expected of physicians in terms of how frequently they need to see patients, how quickly they need to see them, how in some cases in academic institutions they're still fitting in research and teaching of the trainees, that sacred space at the center where it's just the patient and the physician and they have this relationship can really be chipped away at, and how you keep that whole when all of these conflicting priorities are around it is something that medicine is looking at, you know, really carefully.
What are some of the things that doctors are expected to do now that maybe we could outsource to a paid paraprofessionals or even, you know, computers or artificial intelligence to give doctors a little more time and energy with each patient?
If we could find a way to really remove the barriers to effective communication, and you touched on one of, I think, the biggest barriers right now, which is the electronic health record. It was the holy grail for so long to have all of the data in one place and have it all digitized, and we really aspired to that. But what we're realizing is that we're tending to what Abraham Verghese has termed the I patient, the patient that lives in the computer, and we're not tending to the patient in front of us. We're missing opportunities to connect and have eye contact. The next wave, I think, of healthcare will really look at ways that technology can be transformative for the visit, where it can help us to connect and not hinder us, but we're just not there yet.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone to Tim in Keller. Hello, Tim.
Good afternoon. To go to the point that was just made by the doctor, I had the misfortune of spending 22 hours in an emergency room in Dallas with my wife, who had experienced a heart event that turned out not to be a heart attack. But during that 22 hours, what I found was that the hospital had, of course, everyone was hooked up to the monitors for blood pressure, pulse ox, all that kind of stuff. And all of that went to a central station where all of the nurses stayed. They never came into the room unless they were going to draw blood. We were completely disconnected from human contact, pure and simply because they were trying to house as many people as possible with as few doctors as possible. The hospital system is the one that's really creating this issue, and it's getting worse.
What do you think, Rana?
And what I hope that you know, Tim, is that that's not how health providers want it. That's not how doctors or nurses want it. What everyone wants more than anything is that contact and being connected. And it's true that we've built systems now that actually create barriers to that. And we do institutionally have to look at how we dismantle that in a way that brings the provider back to the bedside, because that's where healing occurs.
What was it like for you to go back to work?
It was challenging at first. I had, just as I had had a difficult time identifying myself as a patient, when I went back, I had a difficult time re-identifying as a physician. I felt the emotions of my patients so strongly. I did connect in such a way that it was incredibly draining for me. I worried nonstop about everyone and everything. And I didn't yet have the tools to manage those emotions. What has helped me with time is really learning strategies for mindfulness, for communication, for being present and not having it deplete me. But at first, it was very difficult.
A couple of years later, you and your husband decided to try again to get pregnant. People in your life said some pretty appalling things to you. They cared about you, but they said appalling things to you.
It was definitely out of love. No, and, you know, we tend to talk freely in hospitals. We're surrounded by so much all the time that we edit out a lot of the politeness. So what I heard more than anything was, oh, great, you're really going to die this time. Great, you know. And it was interesting because I really had this feeling that I was making a choice now to go down this path where I might die. And so it would actually be my fault this time. I had a lot of that sort of blame. But at the same time, I had that incredible sense of peace within my body that I just knew it was going to be okay. And it wasn't something I could describe, but I knew I'd be safe and the baby would be safe.
You had the experience of caring for patients who had the exact same illness that you had.
I did. Actually, my very first patient back when I went back to the ICU as a physician was a young woman who had HELLP syndrome, and she had had the baby. The baby was alive, and she ultimately did not survive. And what was shocking to me about that, what I really think, you know, I learned from her, among other things, was that when I was sick, I really believed that if everyone cared enough, if the physicians and nurses cared about me enough, that they could keep me alive through sheer will, that that was all I needed. And what I learned was how little we control the outcome, how I couldn't have cared more about this woman. I couldn't have been more invested in her outcome. I felt, in essence, that I was caring for a replica of myself from 6 months prior, and I wanted more than anything to return her to her family and her new baby, and ultimately I couldn't. And that was a real reckoning for me, because it taught me that there are true limits to what we can do, and that we are not in control, and we can do the best possible job, and we can still lose our patients. And we need to have mechanisms built into the system that support caregivers, because I had a tremendous amount of guilt about that, and I didn't know what to do with it.
Did your patient know she was going to die by the end?
She never regained consciousness, so she did not, but her family had to watch that.
And the family was quite kind to you. They knew you tried your best.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, they were very supportive of me. They had heard already before I had even met them that I had had a similar illness. And I represented hope to them that their daughter would recover. And they so appreciated the care that we provided.
How do you recommend that people advocate for themselves and for their loved ones as patients without getting the dreaded difficult label? How to stand up for oneself or somebody you care about in a hospital setting?
I think the first step is truly believing that you have a right to be an advocate. And we relinquish so much control when we go into a hospital. We accept that there are these caregivers who have more knowledge about these things, but it's our body. We have a right to be informed about it and not have anything happen to us without our own involvement. It is true that this is a paradigm shift, and people will encounter providers who aren't used to that or find it off-putting, but ultimately we have to reclaim our agency, because it has to be a partnership. I've learned that without that, you can't heal. It can't just be care that's directed towards you. You have to believe in what's being done.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Karen in Dallas. Hi, Karen.
Good morning, or it's afternoon now. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate what the physician has to say and the feeling she experienced being not only a physician as a patient. I am a nurse, and similar training where you talk about the disease versus the patient. And once you become the patient and you lose that power, it is a very, very difficult thing. In addition to being a clinical nurse, I also work with hospitals for compliance to the Joint Commission standards and Medicare conditions of participation. So my knowledge level is a little bit different. And the hospital staff have a little bit of a time being challenged when you're sharing with them some variances with infection control practices and so forth. And you do feel that there may be repercussions. But what you just said about being an advocate is so, so important. An advocate for yourself and an advocate for your family.
Thank you so much for your call.
And if we all do that, if we all claim that as our right, the tide will turn. It will become the norm. I think we're in the midst of a culture shift. We'd already gone from a very paternalistic model of sort of doctor knows best back in the 40s and 50s to one that was more shared decision making. And now I really think we're being led by our patients. We're looking so much more at what their values are and aligning what we can offer with their goals and values in a way that's authentic to who they are. Because as medicine has more and more it can offer, it's so important to know that we're offering what the patient desires and not just what's available. The only way to do that is through authentic conversation where you know your patient's values.
Looking back on your work before you got sick and the times that you failed patients, maybe emotionally, without realizing it and without meaning to do them anything but good, have you forgiven yourself for those mistakes?
I can look at the person who did that and say that she didn't know any better at the time. I'm specifically thinking of an instance where, you know, I almost chastised a patient. I said, "You really scared me last night," because that was true. I felt scared. She was decompensating. I didn't want anything bad to happen to her, and I was scared. That was a true statement, what I said, but she should not have been the recipient of it. There's a way to tell people that you care about them and you worry about them without making them hold your pain.
You write here about lots of people who did regrettable things regarding your care. And somehow you also make it clear that these were all individuals who were doing their best. They just didn't always have what it took to give you emotionally what you needed. Were you concerned about colleagues reading this book, finding themselves in it and saying, "Well, she's wrong. That's not the way I treat my patients"?
You know, there were so many examples of wonderful care that, you know, ran alongside all of those mistakes, so to speak. And the only reason I was able to give myself permission to talk about the things that went badly was because every single thing that I saw happen was something that I had done myself. And I knew that I hadn't done it from a place of malice, that I had done it because I didn't know any better. And by admitting that, by saying it's not the person, it's the culture, it's not just the culture, it's the system, it's the educational system, it's the healthcare system, there's no individual blame here. This is truly something we've created that I think we have an opportunity to reflect on and think about how we can all be better.
Is there a part of you that feels like this happened to you for a reason?
That's something that I hear a lot from people, that I had this experience so that I could go forward in this way. I think what feels more true to me is that I've always looked at everything as an opportunity to learn from. Mm-hmm. And even just dying in this way was an opportunity to really learn things that I didn't know. You know, I thought my education was done when I finished my fellowship training, but because the universe understands irony, it showed me I had everything yet to learn.
Dr. Rana Oddish is a critical care physician and medical director of care experience for the Henry Ford Health System. Her book is called In Shock: My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. Rana, it's been such an interesting conversation. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. And I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.